Conscious Living and Power Radio. Hi there, I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate your time. Hopefully, there's all sorts of stuff to keep you occupied, preoccupied, and entertained in one way, shape, or form. I find plenty of stuff every day and easily digress or transit or get derailed. Depends on your point of view. But I find it fascinating because there are so many things here that we can entertained by. And I think that's the wonder of being alive, is that anything is possible. And it all depends on your focus. And a lot of it depends on upbringing. But there's something to be said for individual choice and purpose and awareness. And so I wanted to get back into the topic of near-death experiences. Angels in the OR by Tricia Barker is one of those stories that, you know, and unless you've been there, done that, it's easy to have a conversation and expound on the potentials and say it's real and it isn't real. And I've never had any doubt, but I've had experiences myself which challenge the consensus view of our reality at this point in time. And so for me, these are reminders and touchstones and a way to go back and say, hey, yeah. Here's somebody else who has a great perspective. And what did you learn? So that's what the book is about. And Tricia, you kind of did the let's do it all first and then come back and see why maybe that wasn't the direct direction I wanted to go. So maybe like that.
Yeah. You know, the near-death experience changed everything about the way that I looked at life. I was agnostic at the time and very worldly, very materialistic and driven in that way because I grew up poor. And, you know, there were so many moments in life where I questioned what happened when we died and I kind of feared what happened when we died. But yeah, that experience changed everything.
I like the perspective because when you go into the OR and this is right after the accident, the doctor, and you finally get one after being pretty much ignored for a while, a long while, the doctor that you at the time when you do all the questions of, you know, how are you worthy of operating on me aside from help, please, you can't say no. The BMW, you were impressed by the BMW, and afterwards you were impressed by the angels in the OR. So it was like, you know, before and after, massive change.
Yeah, I was talking with a near-death experiencer the other day, and he was saying, you can't take any of that with you. You can't shove it all up inside you and take that BMW to heaven. You know, like, all you're taking with you is the love that you gave to this world and the love that you experienced. And that's not, you know, when people say love, you know, that sounds so woo-woo and fluffy, but what it means is just the goodness that you added to this world. What did your life add to this world in a good way? How did you make people feel good? And that's your soul's wealth, in a sense. And so that idea of the BMW didn't matter at all. You know, it was like, yeah, wow, there's this whole higher consciousness, there's these evolved beings, these light beings that help neurosurgeons. There's so much more to this reality than we realize as we're walking around with a materialistic mindset. And what really matters is, can we share a moment here? Can we really connect?
Well, and then the thing you took to heart was the information, the instruction that you will become a teacher. And we'll get into that in just a minute. But what I find fascinating, the teacher, but the fact that before going into that, you know, there was a lot of you were more focused on what would support you. And I could see that, you know, just in terms of your upbringing, you say, I don't want to be poor. I want to be well off. I want to be able to do what I want, you know, call my own shots. And the teaching aspect might have been like, you're kidding. But with grandpa, while you're there, you're a younger version of your grandpa. What was that like?
Yeah. So, you cut out just a little bit, but I think you asked a question about my grandfather, and he was the only person who I knew who I was close to who had died. Of course, you know, their ancestors and people who had died who I wasn't familiar with or didn't know on a personal level, but I knew him. He died when I was 9 or 10, and then I had the near-death experience when I was 22. And he was such a beautiful person in that realm. You know, he looked so much younger. His skin glowed, much like the angels. He communicated with telepathy. So there's a lot of communication when you become the consciousness of your soul outside of body. You just know certain things without them having to be said. And so I felt his love. I felt his comfort. I felt that you know, he was really just telling me in that moment, hey, I'm just here with you to help in this transition. And at some point he looked to me and asked if I wanted to continue on, but I knew everything was going to be fine, whether I died and stayed in that realm or whether I went back. Like, his presence was there to guide me. And I think many people, when they die, there's lots of deathbed visions where they see their brother, sister, mother, father, you know, someone who is close to them, who's transitioned over. And when my own father died, you know, many years later, I knew that his parents were there to be the guide. So in a sense, he was my guide in that realm.
Well, and you said, I mean, in the book, you talked about being able to say goodbye, not at the time of death, but just before. And there's a sense of that when you reconnected with him the two or three times that he checked back in, that sense of kind of wanting to be where he was, because, and this is, I'm just reconnected with PMH Atwater talking about what happens for people who have the near-death experience. And, you know, that sense of longing of the things aren't as good here as they could be. And I'm not able to fix that. So how come I can't just skip a few lessons and go back home? So how does that work?
You know, there's a lot to the experience. My experience happened in 1994, and I think the world has become so much more open to the idea of mediumship or connecting with ancestors or, you know, talking with our loved ones or just getting those messages. And I think a lot of people who've lost someone have had a profound dream about them that they know is spiritual or they know there's a connection to them. But it took me a long while. You know, it wasn't immediate, but there were, to talk openly about it, there were always these moments. I would know, like, my grandfather's wife, my grandmother, died when I was in my 20s after the near-death experience, and I knew when she was going to die. I looked in her eyes, I knew it was coming, and I could just see the light coming for her, and I knew that that would happen. And then I felt both of them at different times, painful times in my life, you know, when I needed comfort and no one was around. I felt their love just like pour in from the other side, as if I'm still their little granddaughter, still their child that they love so much and they want to comfort. And in key moments in life, whether it's an achievement or a painful moment, I know that they're there. And I wish everyone could feel that and be assured of that. And I know other people wish it too. I know it's something that people want. And I just want to say it's there. They are there. They are sending love and they are caring.
Well, and you got that experience because in the NDE state, you were aware of the prayers and of those who were connected very, very much, you know, a present form related, but really not connected. You had that advantage of being able to see those connections from that realm.
Yeah. That we are deeply connected to one another, and that, you know, I heard every word that they said, but it was very quickly. But I also knew the connection of feeling that they brought to the prayer, and that interests me because, you know, some people are more sincere. Some people pray out of duty. Some people say they pray and they're not praying. There's a lot to it. And so I felt, I think what struck me is I felt who loved me the most or who cared the most. You know, I could feel their heart. And I guess I would want to remind people too who've lost someone and maybe they've prayed that person, you know, find healing or stay, that their prayer was not lost, that person truly felt it, you know, that in their heart, they knew you loved them and they didn't leave this earth wondering if you loved them. It's known we are connected. And in that realm, there's much greater consciousness and, you know, there's much greater connection. That's just obvious. And of course, you know, if someone loves you.
And before we get into the teaching aspect, the angels, that's what is, I think, the most profound, because you were able to see them work through the medics. You could see that as it was happening. And, you know, for a quick moment before you transitioned on to other pieces of important information, what was that like?
Yeah, I have to say, it shocks me. So, you know, if you realize the consciousness of an agnostic. I mean, just the first moments outside of my body, when I was looking at my body on the operating table, I was in absolute shock and pretty happy that we'd go on, because I immediately knew that this consciousness outside of my body was clearer, crisper. You know, it filled up the room. I could see from many different vantage points. And I knew that this was not a trick of the mind, not my brain shutting down. But what stunned me were the angels. So, like, you know, my brain could, as an agnostic, I could go, okay, cool, consciousness survives. But then when I saw the angels, I was like, what is this? This is different. This is otherworldly. This is, I felt like a kid. You know, they were so unexpected. You know, the Bible mentions angels briefly, but I think the metaphysical community embraces the idea of them much more so than, you know, many religions. And I just didn't have much of a grasp of the idea of angels. And they were so intelligent. That was my first thought, was, wow, these are highly intelligent beings just here for me, just here for my healing. And I bet the neurosurgeons would laugh or freak out or be angry that, you know, that their skill is not just their skill, but it is assisted from these highly intelligent beings. And and as I watched them send this light through the surgeons and into my body, I knew that they were assisting with the healing. Maybe, you know, maybe the neurosurgeons were highly talented, but they were just adding that extra bit of spiritual healing and physical healing in that realm. And I thought, okay, I am going to be fine because these angels are here.
Well, and that part of it is there were extensive damages. Okay. So let's not gloss over that. That's why this little extra kick was probably very helpful.
Yeah. So I think the neurosurgeons themselves were very pleased with the surgery afterwards, because I had lost feeling in my left leg when I went into surgery, and I was wondering if I was going to be in a wheelchair, if I was going to walk. And the spinal fragment, or the fragments of bone from my vertebrae, were pressing on the spine in various areas. So they had to take all of those pieces out. They had to reconstruct new bone from bone in my hip and put rods in. And yeah, it was an extensive surgery. And the cause of death was actually internal bleeding. I bled to death, you know, because there were internal injuries. And there's, you know, that's an added complication to the already spinal surgery. So I think the angels were there for that bit of, okay, you'll walk, you'll run, you know, you're not going to bleed to death, and we're here.
Right. Right. Well, and that's part of it. I know. And again, you're saying with 1994, which the surgeon, when you tried to connect with her and share this epiphany and share all this wondrous stuff, she's like, you'll be fine. Okay. Yeah. There was a lot of blood. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, keep it real. I'm just the surgeon, and, you know, you have a life. So, no malpractice, please. You could tell the responses that you include in the book, that somebody was, that she didn't have, I think, because of her credentials, because of saving her license and those kinds of things, she didn't have a comfort level of even acknowledging your near-death experiences. And I don't think that was about you. I think, obviously, it wasn't about you. It was about her being guarded and trying not to rock the boat by saying something that at that time was extremely, I think, risky. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and, you know, in the writing of the book, and I've been on different shows, like, I survived Beyond the Back, and they researched her, tried to get in touch with her to see if she would comment. And basically, she died 8 years after my surgery, and she was a young surgeon, and she died in a car wreck, a head-on collision. And Austin had this deficit of not having enough neurosurgeons, and I waited 17 hours. People were waiting 34 hours, just crazy amounts of hours for a surgeon. And I found out more about her, and she was doing groundbreaking work. Like, she was a pioneer. She was, you know, she was a great surgeon, and I was really lucky to have her. And I think she just wanted to focus on, hey, I did a great job. You know, let's look at the fact that you're walking, and, you know, you're going to be fine, and you know, let's move on.
Yeah. Well, she didn't want to get into the death. That. Yeah. The death, that was too raw. And I like that you did the follow up on her, because for me, from the perspective that I have, it's knowing that the surgeon at that point in time would have been between a rock and a hard place, acknowledging that and possibly getting distracted. You know, it's a very big topic and a very big experience. And since she is deceased, and especially the car accident, that's an interesting synchronicity.
It is. I've talked. I have given book signings out in California, and this woman came up to me, and she didn't really know anything about my surgeon, and she was a medium, and she said, I think your surgeon wants you to connect with her on the other side, that she wants to kind of be your parent or your guardian, or just kind of help you in some way. And I thought, oh, that's so beautiful. That's so lovely. Like, maybe we didn't have that connection in life to talk about it, but now we're connected on the other side.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. The other thing, I have a question for you. Does Gabriel, the angel, does that sit well with you? Or do you have an acknowledgement or any kind of sense of Gabriel in your life?
Oh, you know, I work with a lot of angels, so that name definitely gives me great peace. And, you know, I don't name them too often, but there's a deep peace when you say it that comes into my body. So certainly I must work with him. But, you know, it's only been, I'll tell you, this is kind of strange. It's only been, I guess, the past couple of years, really this last year, that, you know, since the book has been out, where I've allowed myself to visually see angels more often. And I have seen them, like, in times I was driving in some rough conditions, and I asked for the angels to be there, and they kind of playfully showed me that they were almost like a tank around my car. They were protecting me, and it made me laugh, because I was like, they, you know, almost like Transformers. They put their bodies into this weird form.
Yes.
Because they can morph themselves in that way. And I was like, well, thanks. That makes me feel good.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, and so, okay, so let's, the teaching aspect, because my thought and my experience, it was an overnight dream where there was somebody standing beside my body, and the word was almost like check, and like she was checking my temperature or checking my health status, it was enough that I knew, okay, wait a second, this is not a dream, and yet I couldn't hold it. And, but it was enough for me to be able to remember it and know that there was somebody was checking in, and the message was Gabriel, and the message was the angels are important. And when we stop blocking them, we can see them. But that was one, you had a conversation at some point in the book when somebody asked you about that, you said it made you sad because you were remembering that you had disconnected. Well, you didn't disconnect. You took a little break to get your game on with teaching. And then you, in the book, you're saying, well, I've done my job. I'm cleared. But no. You've done the preparation to be a teacher. You're now schooled in being a teacher. And so now you've got that PhD, and some of the kids you worked with are fantastic. Of course, you have wins, and you have the others that go their own way. But that the stories of the ones that were open, that needed to hear from you, are priceless. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I loved writing about the students because, you know, writing a memoir, you're writing so much about yourself. And I realized, like, teaching was such a gift from God to me because it put me in the lives of so many people in a helping profession, in a way where I could mentor people and assist in their greater good for their lives. I mean, it's really simple. And that that profession just is a beautiful profession, and God must have, you know, had a plan in that sense. But yeah, the students who I was surprised that just a little bit of encouragement would sometimes change their lives. And I thought, wow, is the world that hungry for encouragement that all you have to say is, you're a good writer, and then someone goes out and becomes a journalist? Or, wow, you seem to have a talent for athletics, and they get a full ride to, you know, a different college. You know, like, it amazes me that people are just so hungry for acknowledgement, and there's so much pain in the lives of young people, that whether they come from a good home and they're bullied, or whether they come from, you know, a troubled home, they all seem to need someone to believe in them. And if I could be that person at times, and I really do feel like the other side was assisting me in just giving that basic kindness and love and belief and hope in someone that fueled them at a time when they needed it.
Well, and there's one kid who's pretty troubled, and your supervising teacher is saying, no, he won't be in school long anyway, so don't even bother. And that, I think, was because she had given up, not because it was going to happen to you, but she was voicing her own frustration. And I think it's because she lost so many, and, you know, she was going by numbers of, I've lost 100. What difference does one more make? Instead of going, I had 100 and I helped five, and those five are extraordinary. The numbers game, I think, sometimes interferes with our successes. Our view of success is it's quantity and not quality. And so I think you talk about how you were able to connect with that one individual.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit of optimism too, because I look at the conversations and I pray and I hope, and in my mind, you know, I don't know what happened to him, but I certainly hope that my conversation about, hey, you have a talent for fixing cars, what if you left this lifestyle of his brother was in a gang and he was in a gang, and said, what if you're not just an ordinary life where you fix cars and, you know, didn't worry about the law and, you know, you just had a decent life, or maybe you went to community college, or I think you can do it. I think you're plenty smart enough. And that idea, maybe it sank in, and maybe, you know, he doesn't worry about a life of crime. And I can hope that. And that's a success. And I think school districts look at numbers like, oh, this person dropped out. Yeah, but what if this person didn't go to jail and they ended up working at a trade school? That's a success, or going to a trade school. That's a success too. You know, like that's, you know, it's not all numbers, you know, like
right.
Did everyone get a good grade on this standardized test? No, it's about, hey, did they find their purpose and
right.
work it out at some point?
Yeah. And see, I think too, that even though he was in a gang, the demonstration, there was an interaction where he came to somebody's defense, and maybe he wouldn't have done that or wouldn't have acted out in that way without the encouragement you gave. And it doesn't matter where he ended up, in my opinion. It's the way that you were able to influence at that time, potentially influenced him to step out of that drama, to be able to help somebody in that moment and then transition. You know, it's that thing is, we don't get to see the big picture, but these little tiny things that you are doing are so they're fabulous, because they have threads and they go out and they touch others just because of that one moment of true authentic engagement, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, these moments seem sacred and they seemed important in some way, and it is that thread that goes through. You don't know what that moment means to the rest of their life, or to the kid they have someday, or to, you know, whatever becomes of their life.
All right. When you are dealing with this, the after effects of the near-death experience, you are having, in terms of, you know, a greater awareness, more PSI types of engagements. What, I guess maybe I want to know, is some of that still with you? Because for a while you were kind of overwhelmed or aware with premonitions of things that were going on around you. And it was a new trip, should I say?
Yeah, you know, I consciously asked for that to go away, but it would come back at different points in my life. And I sometimes would feel like Groundhog Day, you know, where I would know the whole day before the day would happen. And it was disorienting. I would say that I've mastered, I think, the art of trying to stay more so in the moment and less in my intuition, and only use intuition after meditation or early in the morning, and kind of making it fit into that particular part of my day. Or if I'm giving a reading, you know, like I think using that information to help someone allows me to access it. But yeah, it was new, it was different and disorienting and kind of wild. I called it being unstuck in time, because the near-death experience was this timeless place. And then we come back to this body, and our consciousness is trapped in the body. And yet we feel out of time, you know, outside of time. Like, oh, wait, why do I know that this is going to happen 10 minutes from now? You know, is life set, you know, or does my free will change it? You know, like what's happening? And so there were all these questions I had, I think, in those early moments. And I didn't have many people to run them by, because I was pretty isolated in Texas in the 90s. You know, I thought about, well, should I drive to Sedona and find, you know, a shaman who's going to help me make sense of this? Or do I just suck through it and go, okay, you know, I have some abilities, can I use them to help my students? Can I use them in my own life? And honestly, I was blind at times. And the only real I guess, solid thought that came to me is when I'm using it to help others, it seems to work best. So if I was using it to help my students, that seemed to be the best way to make it flow.
Okay, let's take a break. We're going to take a break. My guest, Tricia Barker, author of Angels in the OR, Near-Death Experiencer. And I want to go back into that just a moment of what it was like, the overwhelm, because that is one of the hallmarks that people experience afterwards. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. So how do you manage that? Like she said, I manage it. It's Conscious Living and Power Radio. Back in a few.
Okay, Simon, what are you wearing right now?
Nothing.
That's right. And what do people normally wear?
Clothes.
Exactly. So now mommy's going to teach you how to dress yourself. Clothes keep us warm, they look good, and if we go out without them, the neighbors will talk. So it's important to know how to get dressed. Here's how it's done. Underwear always comes first, name tag at the back, then pants, then shirt. Get the first button in the right hole, or you have to start all over. If you're wearing a tie, it goes over, round, round, through, and pull tight. Tuck your shirt into your pants and zip up your flap. Socks go in first, then shoes, right on right, left on left. With shoelaces, just take the ends, cross them over, switch the loops, the rabbit goes down the hole, pull tight, and you're left with bunny ears.
I love bunnies.
Good to know. Now remember, spots don't go with stripes, socks don't go with sandals, and if you've tucked in your shirt, wear a belt. Got it? Why are your pants on your head?
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. But spending just 2 minutes twice a day making sure they brush their teeth is easier and could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. That's 2min2x.org. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Great party, huh, guys?
Yeah, it is. This is so great.
I do say so myself. Hey, did you know that birthday parties actually help build confidence in kids?
Yeah, I did know that.
Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Right, of course.
Yeah, I knew that. Did you know that strollers have the right of way on sidewalks?
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, that's true. Did you know that friendly kids statistically have more friends?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, so obvious.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
I think I knew that.
No, you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Dave, what are you doing?
Just sending a gift to Dave 2037.
Who?
Me in the future. I save a little money from every paycheck for Dave 2037 so he can buy anti-gravity boots or a hologram Doberman. What are you getting Steve 2037?
Steve 2037 will be just fine.
Well, okay, but don't expect to borrow my anti-gravity boots.
Save something for the future. Put away a few bucks, feel like a million bucks. For free ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
You are a waste. A loser. Everyone hates you. Why don't you just stay in your car and keep driving? I'm serious. Drive until you run out of gas, then get out of your car and walk until you find someone who doesn't think you're dumber than bricks. Could take a while, but at least all that walking might burn a couple of calories.
You may not witness bullying like this every day. Your kids do. They want to help, but they don't know how. Visit StopBullying.gov to learn safe, simple ways your child can help stop bullying. Be more than a bystander at StopBullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Conscious Living, my guest, Tricia Barker, Angels in the OR, what dying taught me about healing, survival, and transformation. Now, part of this is because at the very beginning, when you're going into the OR and you're waiting, the attitude adjustment from before the near-death experience to after is pretty profound, but it takes a while to heal some of those relationships because all of a sudden you come back with this expanded awareness and a little bit of overwhelm. But I want to go back into that knowing from that psychic element of having to get reconnected to just being in a physical body, because there's that sense of wanting to be here at the same time. Again, we'll go back into that longing of why? What is this about? And how do I get from point A to point B from doing what you were doing to becoming a teacher?
Yeah, really good question. So many directions to take that answer. I think a lot of near-death experiencers, when you
feel nothing but expanded love and just this deep connection to God, you know, divine intelligence that loves you so much. You come back here and you realize that other people don't know that much about love. They don't know what it's like to ever have felt that. You know, they've had pieces of it from their childhood, and I had kind of a rough childhood. So there was a lot that I was missing it in the form of love before that near-death experience. And, you know, if I talk about it too much, people don't relate to that. They relate more to the struggles of life. And what I found is that I would walk the streets of any particular city. And in those early years, I was so happy just to be alive, just that my consciousness filled up this body. I was walking. It didn't matter if I had on, you know, an old t-shirt and not stylish clothes. I was just walking. And that was, you know, brilliant. That was amazing. I was so grateful for that. And people were overwhelmed with worry, and I could see them consumed in their lives with pain and anguish and worry. And is this going to work out? And, you know, I've failed in my career, or, oh, this person's mad at me. Am I ever going to find someone to love? Like, they just, you know, those constant worries that people have in their minds. And I just wanted to say, hey, look at the tree. Isn't it beautiful? You know, like, let's be children. Let's dance in the street. You know, uh-huh. And, you know, that kind of attitude was looked at like, are you insane?
Like, no, what drugs? What drugs? Yes. Okay. I want some of that. Or maybe you've had too much. Tone it down. Well, okay. And that, okay. As you bring that up though, there's that nature thing, that nature connection that you were so much more aware of.
Yeah, that there's peace and healing in nature. And that was one of my messages in the near-death experience, was remind them to go to nature. And I think as time goes on, and I look at kids who don't even go outside, you know, at different apartment complexes, I'll drive by, there's not a single kid in the pool in the summer. And they're all on video games, all indoors, all at the mall, you know, just that alone. I see so many depressed teenagers and depressed college students who don't know that there's a beautiful river out behind the college where I teach, and I make a point of taking them out to meditate and even walk along the river one day just to assess their moods and go, do I feel better after walking along this river? Do my problems seem smaller? Do I have more clarity after meditation and a walk? And all of them say, even to some level, you know, that they feel better after that. And so I remind them, this is something you can do every day to help your mind, to clear yourself from this constant connection and need for entertainment and choices, because it's not leading to happiness. It's really not. I mean, there are beautiful connections that we make through social media, but we have to be connected to nature and to the people around us, or we're missing out on a big part of life.
Do you do Reiki or healing work of any kind?
You know, I work with the angels, and I will sit with people and we will see what kind of guidance we can get from them. And sometimes that guidance seems to be energy work as well. But I tend to go to a lot of healers myself. You know, like I just find that I'm very sensitive to it, and it's just beautiful work.
You have a huge, huge heart energy. Your heart chakra is absolute. I mean, that's what's causing some of that phasing with this channel. It comes through. The more you talk, the more you tune in, and the more you vibrate that frequency. And so that's what I'm seeing, is that, and sensing and feeling and hearing, is that the more you engage with this and the more you are aligning with that true purpose, then it just comes through you. It's in every pore. And so that's why I was asking, because that hasn't gone away. And the more you are doing this kind of work, the more you're amplifying that. And I'm sure you feel that, but, it's amazing to see that just come through just in the interview. You know, I'm used to being around energy, but definitely with what you have been given, that you have incredibly amplified. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah, it really does. Thank you for saying that, because I do have a heart for people, and I really do want people to be happier and more at peace. And I think that I've asked many times as I'm speaking, you know, whether that's an interview or my YouTube channel or working with students, whatever it may be, that someone experienced a moment of healing that the angels might work through. And maybe it's on an energy level, maybe it's something that's said that gives someone hope and a chance for just a different perspective that adds something beautiful to their lives. So thank you for seeing that.
Well, the thing is, after working in radio and broadcasting and with, you know, electronics and knowing they can go wonky, then we tend to want to fix the electronics. It's like, okay, it's an electronic problem. Well, actually, no, it's a frequency problem. And the person who is on the frequency is kind of jamming the circuit. And so basically with all that fantastic energy, you're jamming the circuit. And that is an indication that it's working, not that there's a problem. It's an indication of this is in flow. This is how it manifests. And so where we want everything to be a certain way when we're using frequencies and, you know, trying to do a radio or television or some kind of broadcast, this is an indicator that there isn't a problem, that there's an amplification. And sometimes it blows our circuits. And that's the highest compliment that we can get. Okay. That it's like, oh, yay, it's on. Okay. And so that I'm like, this is excellent because it's a demonstration and it's a validation of the kind of energy that you're able to transmit and broadcast as you do your work and you connect with people. And for me, I liked it when you got to the end of the book and you said this booming voice, not the end of the book, but close enough. Anyway, the booming voice that said, you're done being a teacher. And you're like, well, okay. And I think there's that apprehensive thing of, uh-oh. does that mean I'm checking out soon? Do I need to go back? Can you do my cards? Do my cards quick, you know, the tea leaves, whatever it takes. Just give me a hint. And I think, you know, from the expanded perspective, you know, they're going, chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. Oh, they're so human. So anyway, but see, my thing was this, what you were doing in a beautiful, wonderful way was learning to be a teacher and learning to connect with people on that level where you were bringing everything to the game, not just the education aspect, but the human aspect and looking in their eyes and seeing, is this person connected? Is there something I can do? Did it make a change when I changed the topic, when I had to meditate? All of those things to help people engage with the content and not necessarily with the individual in front of them, because we tend to, you know, your hair is too short, your dress is too long, all that stuff. And that takes it off the table, because when that heart connection is there, all that stuff suddenly is just like window dressing or, you know, a lampshade. It doesn't, you know, and it's see-through.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad that you picked up on that, because I've read somewhere that you have 15 seconds to change the minds of your students when you first meet them. You know, like they're making judgments about you that quickly. And so I really ramp up the energy in those first 15 seconds, and I'm like sending them love. And the minute I start talking with them, I see some of those defenses fall. Like it's not, you know, they're not judging me based on the way I dress or how I look or, you know, the coffee in my hand or, you know, whatever.
Right.
I mean, some
right.
of that goes on, but it starts to drop, and I see like some recognition in their eyes of, oh, this is going to be one of those professors or teachers who actually cares about me. You know, and I see a little bit of hope flicker on
right.
in their eyes. And I think, oh, it's that simple. You know, we just send them love.
Well, and that's something that I think is sometimes overlooked or discounted or underappreciated, that when we do engage and we are fully present, there's an energy that transmits that. And so you can feel enveloped in someone's presence when they are broadcasting at that level. And that to me is what you demonstrate. And so no matter, it isn't about the words even, it's not about the labels. It's about the simply being in a space and elevating everybody there because of the frequency that you are broadcasting that says, I am present. And so you're bringing that through. And you do mention God a lot in the book, just because of your complete and total shift. And when you say that you connected with the Jesus element, and then your mom gets a different perspective on that, which is like, well, you know, Everybody has their own way to go. But I know that was a challenge when here you had this extraordinary contact and this, you know, been there, done that, here it is. And then it's hard to convince even your closest people with that. How did you deal?
Yeah, you know, since I've started talking publicly more frequently the last 3 years about near-death experiences, I've come to realize, because I've interviewed several near-death experiencers, that we're all attacked by two crowds. And I'll take the atheists any day because they have the same old argument, you know, every time about that's just the brain shutting down. And, you know, they just go for that argument. But there are some people who don't like near-death experiences that don't mirror the Bible exactly, that, you know, talk too much about angels or consciousness or love, or don't see a religious figure, don't see Jesus, and they have a lot of fear, and they want to say that, oh, your whole experience was of the devil, and, you know, that's just, you know, you've been tricked. And that's a hard one for me, because I know my own experience, and I know that it changed me so dramatically. And over the years, I tried to remind my mom, because she was part of a church that discredited near-death experiences because they weren't biblical enough. And I had to remind her that, look, I changed because of that love. My whole entire set point and being and way of being in this world dramatically changed. And I know that that was not of some demonic force. I know that that was touching a love that is greater and offered greater grace and greater peace than anything I'd ever known in this life. And I hope that that sunk in. It may not, you know, yeah, people are ready for the message when they're ready for it. And most of the time they come, people who talk with me who come from extremely evangelical backgrounds or just, you know, by the bookers, as they call it, the Bible. Uh-huh. Usually when they've lost a kid to a drug overdose, or, you know, the family member or loved one has committed suicide, or they are in a place where they're shaken by life, I think they look to these experiences to give them a little hope. And that's usually a moment I've seen when people take, or they wake
some
up
kind of validation.
Yeah, I mean, like, there are people who will literally call me and they, you know, will pay for time with me simply because they're surrounded by people and they love these people who think differently from them, and they just want to talk with someone a little more open-minded. I find that kind of cute and funny.
Yeah. Who gets them? Yeah. It's like, okay, it's okay for me to think these things because you died and you came back and everything is good.
Yeah. And I don't believe everything that everyone around me believes. I just
right.
Like a moment.
Yeah. Well, and part of this too, I think it's interesting because we have certain concepts and preconceived socially mandated kinds of ways to think or be or act, systems that have been long established that are supposed to solve all of our ills. And we still are compounding our ills by doing everything we're not supposed to be doing according to those systems. And so it's like, okay, what's really relevant here? And it goes back to, do you love? Are you loved? Can you love? What is love? And that one seems to be a big struggle. Gee.
Yeah. So some of the near-death experiencers who I've interviewed who have had a more religious experience, like Howard Storm, he told me in an interview that the toughest thing to teach his congregation was to love others who are not like them. So people who were not Christians, love them. People who were, you know, a different race, love them. You know, to love everyone. He said that was the hardest concept for people.
And see, that's supposedly one of the biggies, love. And so as long as we're struggling with love, well, we got some things to work through.
Yeah, you know, and that was the concept that I wanted, you know, my family to get as well, that, look, I could be the prodigal daughter, I could be, you know, the wild one, or the one that you think is should go to hell, and I'm loved just as much as you, so think how much you're loved. We're all loved, you know.
Yeah.
We're truly, truly loved. We're not doing this wrong. We're doing it, you know, according to our own soul's plan, and just be certain that you're loved. It's not a competition. I
okay.
love just as much as you.
When you go back into the angels, because there's a lot of interest and there are people who will tell you, well, you're in the company of angels and I see them all around you. And you said you have moments when they are present, like if you're in danger or if there are worries or whatever. How do you suggest, since you've been there, done that, making yourself a little more aware of that presence around you? What do you suggest?
I ask people, and I do this with myself as well, to verbally ask. And those are the times I've seen them. When I felt afraid, I will ask out loud and say, I need you in my life right now. I need some extra guidance or protection. But there are people who call in angels frequently to help when they take their vitamins or their medicine, you know, that may this medicine help my body. Please add that extra energy, that extra love. And people who are now, you brought up Reiki. There are several Reiki workers who are actually outside of operating rooms in hospitals, working with people as they go into surgery. And that makes me so happy because I think, yes, you know, the angels are there. Why not, you know, have people ask for more? And so I've had people going into surgery email me and say that they've connected with their angels before that surgery and they know they're going to be okay. And they believe in that connection. So I would say just verbally ask for them and make yourself more aware. And when you can't see them, which most of the time that isn't what people are open to, because that makes you wonder, you know, too much. Not everyone wants to visually see them. The energy is beautiful. So if you close your eyes in meditation and ask for them to be with you, you might feel a presence at your right side or left side, and that presence can send you extra love and healing as you're in meditation.
Now you're describing lights, but so what is it like to see the angels? What do they look like? What did they look like to you?
You know, they can be very large, even larger than the ones I saw in surgery. So the ones in surgery were 9 feet. I asked for protection, and I don't know if these are guardian angels, but they looked even larger at one time. They look to be, you know, just monstrously large, but beautifully large. And I remember looking up and going, okay, I feel safe, you know, thanks. And maybe it's their playful way of manipulating their form to make you feel better in that moment that they are with you. And I think they can change their forms to some degree. And that's part of why, you know, we're met with what we need in a moment, and we're met with what we need on the other side too. So maybe that's why descriptions are different from person to person, that they're meeting us where we need them.
I can't remember who it was, but somebody, the person who met them, well, the being who met him was a cat. And that was because that was one of the, he had a very strong relationship with the cat, and the cat was there like, okay, good to see you.
Yeah, I love those stories of people on the other side. I think it was Jan Price who was first met by her dog, a golden retriever. And to her, that was love. And so the dog came bounding toward her full of love. And so many of us do have that unconditional love bond with our pets. And so it makes sense that they'd be there.
Well, so for going forward, there is a part of the book that talks about a script in progress. Are you any ideas on how long or what's going to come with that?
Well, it was a ton of fun, and I went with faith and guidance with this. But one of the editors of my book, Chris Breathway, he had worked on short films, and I said, well, and he's always wanted to write a longer film, and I said, well, you have such an understanding of near-death experiences, let's just write the script together. And so we had a ton of fun doing that, and we just finished it up. And now I think after the book, I've kind of focused on the book for a while since that came out in April. I think now I'm just beginning to think, well, what are the next steps to making this a movie? Because there's so many people who don't read, and, you know, I'm not glad the book is available in Audible, but the big screen and Netflix and Amazon and all these different outlets, I think, get into people's consciousness on a different level. It becomes more mainstream, and I'd love to see my near-death experience and others become more mainstream, but my story is one of healing and
I've been through a lot in life, and I think that that's why I want my story out there, because I want people with PTSD and complex PTSD and wounds to know that you can live a beautiful life, and those spiritual lessons and that spiritual healing is available to all of us, and it changes everything.
Well, we glossed over the part about the drugs, and you do name several that were quite appealing, and you test drove for a while. So that helped you with some of the students who were in the throes of that kind of activity. And that part, I think, gives you grounding, because it says there's a broad background of troubling or challenging situations that you had to deal with and reconcile after your NDE. What is it that you really want to get across, the point that you would like to make?
That love is all that matters and all that we take with us. So we get so caught up in what we're living, what we're doing, our careers, and in that moment that our souls leave our body, there's nothing to fear. We go on after death, and what we're taking with us is all that love that we exchanged with this world, whether it was love for a tree, love for a pet, love for ourselves, love for a community, love that we spread through our family and friends and romantic partners, whatever that love was, it is what we take with us. And so each day, make sure that you're being kind, connecting with others, and being kind to yourself and sending that love to your heart, because the journey is challenging at times, but it's also so much more beautiful when you keep that spiritual principle in mind.
And do you connect with nature?
Oh, yes. Yes. I am so blessed that Fort Worth has this 45 miles of beautiful river, and I can access it different parts of town. I can access it near my work, near my home. There's always an opportunity to go meditate by a tree or walk by the river. I love it.
All right. Angels in the OR. Trisha Barker. What dying taught me about healing, survival, and transformation. Okay. We gloss over some of the nitty gritty of this, and believe me, it's there. Okay. But that's what makes somebody qualified to say, been there, done that. And I am redeemed, and you can be redeemed. So in the bigger picture, you have a message that you're here to share. What's the bottom line?
So the bottom line is that we take the love that we give to this world with us, and that's our soul's greatest journey. So in every moment of your life, when you are giving compassion, when you're giving love, when you're helping someone, you're expanding your own soul, and with greater memories, with greater depth. And so much of what we worry about is not what we need to worry about at all, you know, and how much money we have in the bank, you know, what we are wearing that day. All of these things are not as important as how are we loving, how well are we loving ourselves, our community, those around us. And love is a focus that should be a part of all of our lives.
I want to go back real quick. Your dad checked back in after he died a few times. And yes. What has he given you? What information has he shared?
Oh, well, you know, not lottery numbers.
Darn.
But he has weighed in on people and situations. And at first I related to him as my dad, not as like a cosmic guide. And I've learned to see him more in that guide personality, but he still retains some of his humor and some of his silliness. And one of the things that shocks me, and a lot of people want to weigh in about this, is he seems to be someone who wants to come back. So he is someone who wants to reincarnate, wants to try this again, wants the lessons that he's learned over there to somehow be ingrained in his soul so that he makes better choices and, you know, reaches higher potential in this next life of his. So it's interesting.
Yeah, because that gets into reincarnation, and it gets into, you know, will you recognize him or will he do it while you're here? And that can happen.
Yeah, he wants to. He's like, he tells me all the time, he's like, you're good, Trisha, you're good. You've got this, girl. Let me come back.
And I'm like, that's not fair. I need you to stay there.
Yeah, I can't deal with 2-year-olds. No.
Yeah.
But that's a reassurance, I think, you know, for people to hear that, you know, here's your father. He was here physical, and now he's there on that other side in the ephemeral, the non-corporeal realm, and saying, I got this, I'm going to do this. And you keep trucking, because, you know, I don't have to hold your hand anymore. And surprise, I'm assuming it's a human form he's looking for, and not necessarily like an orca or something else.
Definitely human. He was kind of messed up in his life. But I think that, you know, people don't give enough credit to that. I mean, that's someone who enjoys life. You know, he enjoys the physical. He enjoys food and laughter and all the things that were beautiful about life. And that's an optimistic, comical person. And, you know, we need those types of souls.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you. You have a wonderful laugh. You have a lot of joy. And I'm so glad that you're going to get your story on video. Visual is a lot of our world right now. And it makes an impact. So the more people that have a chance to see that there's more to life than just, you know, going through the motions of 9 to 5. And here's a way that we can deal with that and bring the joy back into the equation. And the LOVE. Thank you, Tricia. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful show. Enjoy it.
And the book, Angels in the OR, you can get it at Amazon. Tricia Barker, you can check out our website, too, just to do a little Google search and you'll find it. Thanks for listening.